From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll revisit our conversation with writer and gerrymandering expert Dave Daly as the U.S. Supreme Court decides to hear Wisconsin's redistricting case.
Later, Wisconsin changed the GED, the high school graduation equivalency test, in 2013. We'll explore the impact of newer, harder tests.
I think now when someone takes a GED test, a much more difficult one, challenging, and they work harder to prepare for it, I think that they are thinking about going to college.
And a new exhibit exposes the animals at the Milwaukee County Zoo from the inside out.
While you walk through the exhibit, you will recognize that all these animals have very much in common with our anatomy, because that's no wonder. We have all the same needs to survive. We are all flesh and blood.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday agreed to take up the constitutional challenge to Wisconsin's redrawn congressional maps. State Republicans redrew those maps back in 2010, and through a process called gerrymandering, gave Republican candidates an advantage, which a federal court has now ruled unconstitutional.
Wisconsin has been ordered to redraw the maps in time for the 2018 election, although the state appealed that decision to the Supreme Court, which will now hear the case, and stayed those redrawn maps.
Writer Dave Daly tackled the issue of gerrymandering in his book, Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. It's an in-depth analysis of the Republicans' 2010 election strategy and the systematic effort to quash voter efficacy through gerrymandering. Daly starts by explaining the process of redistricting a state.
Every 10 years, the Constitution mandates the redrawing of every state legislative district in the country, and then every congressional district in the country. Usually it's for the sake of population balance, and it's done after every census. So the census is conducted in years ending in zero, which means that redistricting usually follows for the next year. That means that elections that end in the year zero can reverberate throughout the course of the next decade and can simply mean more than other elections.
Yeah, so in 2010, we see, especially here in Wisconsin, a lot of Republicans getting into office, and that's a result of Operation Red Map.
2010 is a terrific year for the Republicans nationally. If you remember back to that summer, it's after the Obamacare fight, it's the rise of the Tea Party, it's all the town halls about death panels, and the party that is on the out usually does better in the following midterm year. So the Republicans had the wind at their back, but they also had a plan, and that plan was to use redistricting and the gerrymander that following year in the most sophisticated way that it had ever been done. I mean, gerrymandering goes back to the dawn of the Republic. You can trace it back to Patrick Henry in 1788. But what the Republicans plan in 2010 and Operation Red Map is a systematic state-by-state study of who controls redistricting in states, and then a plan to take over as many legislative chambers across the country as they could in order to have the only voice in the room when it came time to draw at the new lines. They intended to use the 2010 election to lock in control for the next 10 years at least. And in Wisconsin, they were brilliantly and devastatingly effective at this.
I mean, yeah, you look at the election in 2008 and you compare it to 2010, and it's stunning.
It is. But what's also stunning is if you then compare 2010 to the first election run on the new maps in 2012. So the Republicans have a good year in 2010. 2012 is a Democratic year. Barack Obama wins Wisconsin with 53% of the vote. Tammy Baldwin goes to the Senate, wins with 51.5% of the vote. Republicans take 5 of the 8 congressional seats from Wisconsin, despite a minority of the votes. So less than 50% of the votes leads to 62.5% of the seats. That's all at the federal level. In the assembly, it's dramatically different. Something like 56 of the 76 contested races go to Republicans, even though they barely have 50% of the vote. That is wild. When you add in all of the uncontested seats that were won by Democrats, which you should because those seats were uncontested because of the way that they were drawn and because they packed so many Democrats into them, the Democrats have 200,000 more votes in Wisconsin Assembly District than Republicans, but they're staring down a super majority of Republicans. And this matters. It matters, you know, not only in terms of a democracy, but it has, you know, concrete policy implications in Wisconsin.
I mean, let's go back. Let's look at the genesis of Operation Red Map. You mentioned one man quite a lot, Chris Jankowski.
Jankowski is a brilliant strategist, and what he figures out is that the gerrymander can be a really effective tool. Republicans and Democrats, both sides had used it for a long time, but it was usually an instrument of partisan control, you know, both sides saying, don't mess with our seats and we won't mess with yours, or it's a way to, you know, get revenge on a single enemy or something. What Jankowski realizes is that you can exploit this as a political tool, and that the new technology that has come available allows for it to be just devastatingly effective. He's a state government guy. He is the executive director of something called the Republican State Leadership Committee. He's been active in Republican Attorney General's associations over the years, so he knows that you can have more influence on policy when you win elections at a state level, and he also knows that it's really, really cheap to run elections in state legislatures. So they spend $30 million on Red Map. That's all it costs. You can't even run a Senate seat race these days for $30 million. They lock in control of the House of Representatives for a decade for it, and it's all $100,000 in this district, $200,000 in this district. They identify enough districts in each of these states that they're focused on, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, a couple of other ones. They target state legislators, and in the last 6 weeks of the 2010 election, they come in with $18 million of that $30 million, and they dump it mostly into negative ads in state house races, in state assembly races, and it floods all of these Democrats, and there's no way for them to respond to it. So they take out enough people to flip control of these chambers and draw themselves complete control of the redistricting process the following year. And in Wisconsin, it's amazing what that they do. They force it all behind closed doors at the Michael Best law offices. They make even the legislators who want to see what their new districts will look like sign confidentiality papers. It is an amazing, amazing process.
I mean, is that normal? Do they usually do these kinds of things?
No. Frankly, what happens in 2010 and 2011 is redistricting on steroids. It's always been a partisan tool, but in 2010 and 2011, it moves to something else. It becomes a partisan nuclear bomb. It becomes a method of governing from the minority and locking in that control for the course of the next decade. I mean, even Republican legislators who had to sign these papers in Wisconsin said that they'd never seen anything like it before. And three judge panels in the state have frowned on it as well, you know, calling it, you know, an attempt to cover up a process that, you know, should be public and to keep it out of the public view.
Part of why it changed, as you talk a lot about, is that the technology changed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from 2000 to 2010, we were dealing with completely different stuff.
Completely. And it will only change more dramatically between 2010 and 2020. I mean, go back and think about how you texted in the year 2000. I mean, you know, you didn't even have a keyboard on your phone. We were using numbers to adjust to each letter. It took a year to write a sentence. It was the exact same thing as far as computing power. they used computers in 1990 and in 2000 to some extent in redistricting, but it was not as fast, as powerful, and as sophisticated a tool. What they now use is a program called Maptitude, which comes preloaded with all of the census data. So you already have tremendous information on economics, on ethnicity, on religion, and all the demographic data that you would need to know. You can upload into Maptitude, if you're so inclined, and the partisans are, all of the public record data sets that are available. So you can take voting information, who votes, who doesn't vote, precinct and block level results from races going back years all the way down ballot. And so you can tell immediately what the impact is of moving a line one street in one direction. So when you see these maps that look like they're crazy Rorschach tests or something, they are actually very precise and reliable partisan performers. All of those lines are there for a reason. I went out and drove a bunch of these districts around the country, and every time you would see a strange turn or a jut or something that you didn't understand, there would always be a reason. It was because the neighborhood and the demographic changed, and it changed precisely where the lines moved. The technology is that good.
That's intense. That's an intense sort of idea. I mean,
it's only going to get more intense. The technology that they're working on now involves predictive algorithms so that you can use all of this information to try to determine what a district will look like over the course of the next 10 years. So you might draw a line that makes it look like it's a competitive district in 2021, but you know based on the demographic data that the neighborhood is changing and that by 2023 it will have a completely different look. It's the same technology that allows Amazon or Netflix to guess what it is that you might like based on what you've liked in the past, only this has got much more information and it's fundamental to our democracy.
Well, I mean, talk about Big Brother, right?
It is. It is.
The subtitle of the book is The True Story Behind the Secret Plan mm-hmm. to Steal America's Democracy. But I think what was most surprising in your book is that it wasn't really a secret. I mean, Karl Rove, Chris Jankowski, they didn't seem like they were hiding.
No, I think you're right. If I'm guilty of hyperbole anywhere in that over-the-top subtitle, it is with the word secret. The Republicans did, in 2010, lay their cards on the table. I mean, Karl Rove writes an op-ed that runs in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010 that says we are going to take back a Congress by running aggressive races in all of these small towns. And then he names a bunch of them. And he says, we will take back Congress by using redistricting. And he's like, when you draw the lines, you make the rules. And it's just a catastrophic strategic failure by the Democratic Party not to, I mean, I don't know if they just weren't reading the Wall Street Journal that day or what. But Karl Rove meant what he wrote, and the Democrats didn't have the strategic vision to come up with this themselves, but they also didn't have the ability to play defense and sort of block against it. It was a difficult year for them, but they still should have been able to say, well, if we don't want to get shut out completely in each of these states, we have to at least hold on to the Pennsylvania House or the Wisconsin Assembly. And they weren't able to mobilize their resources in a strategic way. I would say that the secret part of this plan comes into effect the following year when the maps are being drawn.
Chris Jankowski seems really proud of Operation Red Map. Republicans seem proud that they're, I mean, in a lot of ways, cheating the system, you know, using loopholes to kind of subvert the importance of your vote.
I think they'd say that it's politics. I think they'd say that we won these elections and you redistrict in 0 years, and if the Democrats didn't figure it out, too bad. You know, I think that they believe that they did their job and that the Democrats did not do theirs. You can certainly quarrel with that as a philosophical sense of of how you look at democracy or the importance of the vote or whether country matters more than party, but that is what they would say.
Well, Dave Daly, thank you so much for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for being interested.
Writer Dave Daly speaking earlier this year with Joy Powers. His book is called Rat Effed, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie North is in the studio along with us this morning as well. We're in the first day of our summer membership drive, and we're just taking a few minutes to share some stories of why public radio is something worth supporting year in and year out. There's also a couple of key reasons why you ought to take a couple minutes now and become a member or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio, not the least of which is we'd love to reach our hourly goal.
We certainly would. That is $650 for this goal, and you can help by calling 414-227-3210. You can also go to the website wuwm.com. And today only you will be entered in to win a $1,000 travel certificate. That is today only. That is Tuesday, June 20th. $1,000 that you could use toward any kind of travel, whether it's air travel, tours, cruises, vacation packages. You can't exchange it for cash, unfortunately, but it is valid for 5 years from the date that it's issued. So that is really cool. And if you're someone like me who loves to travel, I mean, this is something I would be entering like three or four times, Mitch.
Well, and, you know, it turns out that you don't actually have to make a contribution to be entered into the drawing. But of course, your contributions are extremely welcome because they keep programs like Lake Effect on the air each and every day, 5 days, I would say 5 days a week, but 7 days a week, including Lake Effect Weekend as well. It's important for you to become a member and do your part in keeping this show healthy. 414-227-3210 or visit us online and make your secure contribution there at wuwm.com/give. Become a member, renew your membership, become a sustaining member. There are all sorts of great options for you, but the most important one is that member option. Become a member now, 414-227-3210, and thanks.
We'll take a short break now and then have a look at the impact of major changes to the high school equivalency GED test here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Since it was first developed in the 1940s, the GED has been a mainstay for Americans seeking a degree equivalent to a high school diploma. Earning a GED is dependent on passing the GED, a standardized test which gauges a person's knowledge of math, reading, writing, social studies, and science.
In 2013, the American Council on Education announced big changes to both the content of the GED and how it would be administered. There has been some controversy over the changes, particularly because of the major decrease in people passing the test, both locally and nationally.
Edgar Mendez has been reporting on the changes to the GED since they were first announced in 2013. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about what prompted these changes.
The GED test goes through cycles. I think it had been about 15 years since they had last changed it. But every once in a while, like every standardized test, it goes through a change. Now, with this last change, there was the test was created by Pearson View, which is a company that creates online tests. So that was a differentiation. It didn't go through a government organization that usually creates the test. So that was a change. When you talk about 2013, that's when I first started reporting on the GED and the upcoming change. And back then, the four testing centers in Milwaukee, United Migrant Opportunity Services, or UMOS, the SDC, the YWCA, and MATC were in the middle of a big push to get students who'd passed some but not all of the GED tests to come in and complete it, because if they didn't finish, then they would lose progress and have to start over with this new GED test, which was based on higher order thinking or critical thinking, and computer-based was going to be implemented nationwide.
So before this, it wasn't a computer-based test?
Correct. It was a paper test.
What did the test look like in general? Now, you said it became more higher-order thinking test, but what was it before that?
Well, before that, it was like the test that maybe you or I took in school. It was more based on memorization, so memorizing dates, hard numbers. Even the reading portion, they'd give you a statement and ask you to basically back up that statement. So it was basically giving your own opinion. Maybe now the new test, they'll give you two different statements and ask you to choose which one was a stronger argument and then also give the points behind it. So it just basically just more critical thinking.
So a lot of the controversy over the test seems to be based on how it was rolled out. In 2013, they announced that they're going to have a new GED test. What happened after that? What was the process of really implementing this test?
Well, it was going completely online, so all the organizations had to have a computer network set up so they can administer the test. GED instructors, unfortunately, before the rollout, they didn't have the prep materials like they had had for the older tests. So they were behind on that. They were behind on professional development. It was a totally new teaching style, as you can imagine, going from a more memorization-based test to a test that is all about critical thinking. It's kind of like a Common Core approach to GED.
So it seems like the teachers weren't really prepared. The students thereby were not really prepared. And the facilities, in some cases, were not prepared for the changes. What did that mean for the people passing? What did the numbers look like there?
Well, in 2013, the year that they made the big push to get people who would finish some of the tests in, there was nearly 1,600 GED graduates. Now, fast forward to 2014, and it was around 120. So a huge drop.
A huge drop in the people passing. Was there right. a drop in the number of people actually taking the test? Because it seems like it was also more expensive now.
Right. One of the issues with the rollout was the test went up from about $80 to $135, which is the current price. There were people taking the test, but the passing rate was only 47%. So it was still much fewer people taking the test and passing the test.
So a question that I think is a little obvious but also seems like something we should touch on is really why do people take the GED? I mean, there's obviously a number of reasons, but what are some of the big reasons that we see?
Well, I mean, it's when you fill out a job application, they ask you if you have your high school or a GED. So it's basically it helps you get jobs. It helps you get into college. As a matter of fact, not many people will know this, but I dropped out of high school at 17 and went back and got my GED in my early 20s. And that was kind of what led me to college in my mid-20s. So you have that GED in your pocket. You can put it on your application and you can even go to college.
Well, and that's something that educators have talked about with this new test. They've said that, yes, it's a more difficult test, but it's actually preparing people for college. For most GED graduates, is that the end goal?
I think that now with this, the younger generation that's going into the GED test, I think they are looking to go to college more so than maybe before. I know that even back when I was taking my GED test, there was a lot of adults taking their GED test, mothers with children. I think, and that's still the case. But I think now when someone takes a GED test, a much more difficult one, challenging, and they work harder to prepare for it, I think that they are thinking about going to college. And many of the students, GED students that I talked to, were planning on eventually enrolling in either MATC or UWM.
Now, what do most educators think of the test now? It seems like there was a lot of controversy 2014 rolls around, in part because they weren't prepared, but having had some time sitting with the test, learning how to teach the test, what did they think of it?
Well, I think they have mixed feelings. I mean, when they talk about the GED test, they think about it, or they talk about it as, or any education as a way to escape poverty. And when you're dealing with a high poverty population, you want to help as many people get out of poverty as possible, and GED being one of those routes. And when you have so few graduates, I mean, that's kind of not closing one avenue, but it's definitely making things a lot more difficult. Now, there are positives. They do understand that the GED test is more challenging, and students are, after preparing for it and passing it, they're coming out with more skills, and especially the new age skills, the technology skills, the critical thinking skills that are needed for jobs of today. So, I mean, they do see the positives, but one of the challenges is that there's still not enough people taking and passing the test. Now, the passing rate has gone up from 47 to 72% last year, and the number of graduates has risen to 360 last year, but it's still a lot lower than it was in 2013. So essentially, there's a lot less people that are walking out with their GED. And then aside from that, it's taking students a lot longer to prepare for it. I talked to Juan Lopez. He's a Spanish language GED instructor at Journey House, and his situation is extremely challenging. For one, they lost most all their students basically that were preparing for the old GED. You know, for ESL, English second language students, many of the older ones, they weren't as familiar with the computer. So once it went computer based, that was a big issue. I think with the rise in popularity of smartphones, it's sort of mitigating those factors. But I mean, you're talking about most of his students were from Mexico, and generally in Mexico, many people only have a middle school education or less. So asking them to go from middle school to college is a huge jump, and one that many people, you know, end up giving up on when they're taking GED prep classes and realize it's going to take a very long time.
About how long is it taking people to prepare for the test?
Well, at Journey House, the Spanish language students, I spoke to a few that were in classes for over a year. I was just speaking with someone at the YWCA earlier this week as part of another story I'm working on about their HSED, High School Equivalency 5.09 program, which is sort of an offshoot of the GED. And they were saying the same thing, that looking at their numbers in the last few years, it was taking students about a year to get ready to take the GED. And that's just to get ready. So that doesn't even essentially guarantee that they're going to pass the test.
Now, it seems like with the new test, there are a few different ways to pass, three different ways of passing. Is that accurate?
Well, there's three different levels. So the first level signifies that you're high school equivalent. The second one, that you're college ready. And the third one, you'd essentially be saying that you have skills of somebody who's had some kind of college. Now, there are alternatives. And when I talked about the YWCA, and I'm pretty sure, and the SDC has a program like that too, but the 5.09 program is it's like a workforce readiness program. So essentially, it can be put on an application just like a GED. It's not accepted everywhere in the country, but it's definitely accepted here in Milwaukee as a high school equivalency. But what they do is they went away from standardized testing and created their own curriculum that focused more on work readiness. So that it involves 4 weeks of soft skills, and then even their math component has kind of things that you can use at home or use in a workplace. So that's a 20-week program, and that was kind of created out of the need to get more graduates. So they were struggling to get people passing the GED, so they created a new program.
And that's a local program, right?
Right. Well, the 5.09, I believe it runs other places, but I know the SDC and the YWCA has one.
The GED, this test, right, seems to be a nationwide test, standardized from state to state. This process this time was privatized, essentially, with a company that creates standardized tests. And there was some criticism as a result of that. What were critics saying about that process?
Well, people were saying that they made it so difficult in order to kind of de-emphasize the GED, basically to tell people that you're better off staying in school and getting your high school diploma. So that was one criticism. And then another one I heard was the fact that it became more of a Common Core type test. And as you know, there's been much controversy about the Common Core. And in fact, it's been taken out of some states. So that's some of the criticisms. And another criticism is that it would lead to less GED graduates. So as we've seen, that's been the case, not just in Milwaukee, but nationwide.
Well, Edgar, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Edgar Mendez is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he spoke with Joy Powers. You can see his special report on the new GED test at WUWM.com. Well, Mitch, you don't have to pass the GED test to become a member. There is no test required at all. You only have to know how to dial your phone, 414-227-3210. Well, there's one other way you can do it.
And that is by visiting us at WUWM.com/give. And, you know, it's a good reminder, actually, the math on the GED test is a good reminder that the math that we require to keep shows like Lake Effect on the air is pretty simple. Basically, it involves a significant amount of money from people who listen and become members or renew their membership at a public radio station like ours. In fact, as we're talking about Lake Effect, a station very much like ours.
Very much like ours.
Yes. Let's just say ours, 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com/give. And I also wanted to mention that Edgar Mendez is a good example of one of the many kind of media alliances we have that allow us to kind of tap into the journalism expertise of reporters from around the city and around the state. The Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, we've worked with their reporters for a long time. In fact, I remember in 2013 speaking with Edgar Mendez about the changes to the GED test that were about to go into effect. Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, Milwaukee Magazine, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, any number of different journalism reporting outlets from around the city, the state, the country, and even the world. We've talked to reporters from overseas as well. It's a great way for us to kind of tap into, as I say, the expertise of people who are on the ground covering important stories around our city and around the world.
And that's the kind of reporting that you support when you call 414-227-3210. It's the kind of conversations that you expect from Lake Effect. It's the kind of thing that you hear every day, and literally every day. We are on 7 days a week. And we are really pleased to be able to bring you that kind of service. But you are, going back to the math analogy, you are the X part of the equation. We need you to solve for X. And the way you do that is by calling 414-227-3210, and you make a contribution in whatever amount that is comfortable for your budget. Another math equivalency.
Yes, and a couple of ways of saying thank you during this summer membership drive, one of which is throughout the drive, when you make a contribution at the $10 a month or $120 level, you can take advantage of the brand new WUWM Public Radio Nerd T-shirt. It's a great way to share your love for us and for public radio with the world. Comes in two different colors, a smashing gray and
a really stylish black. Black is always, always stylish, Mitch.
Black is the new black.
It is the new black, and so is gray.
Exactly.
In this case. Yes. And they come in unisex sizing, so you can make your choice when you go online if you do it that way, or you can tell the lovely person who answers the phone if you make the phone call. And today only, there is the $1,000 travel certificate. Someone will win it at the end of today. It is $1,000 from Fox World Travel, and you can use it toward air travel, tours, cruises, or vacation packages. So please give us a call, 414-227-3210, or go to online, WUWM.com.
One last break, and then how people visiting the Milwaukee County Zoo this summer will see animals like they have never seen before. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are many animals you can see at the Milwaukee County Zoo which are otherwise impossible to view in Wisconsin: camels, an octopus, giraffes. But an exhibit now open allows visitors to see those animals and some others in a truly unique way.
The anatomy of a variety of animals is on full display in the Body World's Animal Inside Out exhibit, which uses a technique called plastination. It was first used by its inventor, Dr. Gunther von Hagens, to show the human body in a series of Body World's exhibits.
Dr. Angelina Wally is the curator of all of the Body World's exhibits, and I met her out at the Milwaukee County Zoo just as the exhibit was being installed. So, Dr. Wally, it is such a pleasure to see you again. We met many years ago at the Milwaukee Public Museum when the Human Body Worlds exhibit came into town, which was a spectacular exhibit. And now we have animals.
Exactly the same amazing exhibit like Body Worlds, but it, of course, has a completely different angle. It's a quite unique exhibit that allows visitors a unique glimpse into Mother Nature that you will otherwise not have the chance to see. We have a huge collection of specimens on display that unveil all the body interior of a variety of animals. And while you walk through the exhibit, you will recognize that all these animals have very much in common with our anatomy, because that's no wonder. We have all the same needs to survive. We are all flesh and blood. We all breathe in the same air for life. We need to convert food into energy. So if you think about that, that makes it very clear that our anatomy must have very much in common as well.
Yeah, we just do it differently. We have, you know, we have the same needs, but there are different ways all the different species go about meeting those needs.
Yes, absolutely, but nonetheless, each larger animal, at least the vertebrates, they have a skeleton. And there are animals that have their skeleton outside and others have that inside, like we have. All larger animals have a kind of controlling system, that is the nervous system. They have a brain and they have peripheral nerves. They have a heart to make the blood run throughout the entire body. They have artery, they have veins, they have digestive organs. So this is all what these animals, including ourselves, have in common.
Did Body Worlds start with humans and then move into the rest of the animal kingdom, or did you start with animals and then move to humans?
No, it is exactly the first way. Both my husband, Gunther von Hagens, and I, we are physicians, so we are trained in human anatomy. And when my husband invented the technology, his idea was to be able to enhance teaching anatomy at universities and medical schools. And only a lot later, we came across this idea to make a public exhibition out of it. And of course, working in a human anatomy environment, we started with human specimens, but over the many years, we perceived animal donations. So whenever an animal was finished, I included this in our human exhibits, and I was fascinated to see our visitors' reaction. They so much appreciate the ability to really compare and see the difference on one hand, but the similarities on the same hand as well. So we kept being motivated to continue with also plastinating animals. And years ago, there was a time when we thought that it's such a beautiful collection of animal specimens already. Let's make an animal exhibit out of it.
And we walk in and there are two beautiful squid.
Yes, we are very happy to be able to have in this exhibit a giant squid that was found dead at the shore of Australia, and because of a particular cooperation we had with a scientific institute there, we were able to perceive it and maintain it for our exhibit. And it's really huge, and I'm sure no one has ever seen an animal like this of those who will come and see the Animal Inside Out here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I've never seen a squid alive. I've only ever seen pictures. Mm. And so this is the closest probably I will ever see one alive.
You know? I guess so.
Yeah. And we have, this is a shark.
behind us. And we're going to be walking through about this octopus. We happen to be, I think we're in the ocean worlds right now.
Exactly. Yeah. I start the exhibit with the ocean world, and then we dive into the vertebrates world, so to say. And here we really start with the anatomy. And similar as with our Body Worlds exhibition, I like to start with a locomotive system. I start with a skeleton, and we are looking here at a lobster. And you may ask yourself, why do we have a lobster here? Well, that's because of the skeleton. The lobster has a skeleton outside. That's called an exoskeleton. And vertebrates, like the oryx over there, that has an internal skeleton. On this side, we have a skeleton of a little pigeon in comparison to that of an ostrich. And as you know, the ostrich is the largest but also heaviest bird in our modern world. And because of its heavy weight, it cannot fly. You can see it really by the anatomy, because the breastbone there, it's very flat. The breastbone is a part of the skeleton where the flight muscle would attach. But since the bird doesn't use the flight muscle, it is somehow short or flat. But the pigeon has a really strong
point.
That's called a keel. And even this tiny bird has such a strong keel, and it must have had really strong flight muscles.
Well, and you can also see when you look at the ostrich skeleton, the actual wing bones are very short.
Exactly, they are very short, but if you compare that with the human skeleton over there, you will detect pretty great similarities. The bones of the legs, for instance, are very similar.
Yeah, they are. They bend differently, but they...
Yes.
But they are very similar. Mm. It's so interesting to see how much we are part. We always forget that we're part of nature, I think.
Exactly.
We like to think we're somehow different.
This is actually what I hope what our visitors will take away from here, that we are part of a big, wonderful thing, that we are nature ourselves, and that nature is very, very fragile. And I do hope that people really leave the exhibition with a greater respect for all these creatures and for life.
So we move from the skeletons, and then we get into the wonderful way that you show muscles and you show the circulatory systems in these animals.
Exactly. The next part of the locomotive system would be the muscles. Here we have an entire goat where we have dissected all the muscles that are just underneath the skin. On the other side, we have that of a filly, and we have additionally taken out the internal organs and placed them aside. So although the thorax and abdominal cavities seem closed, these are the actual organs from that filly. You see the long trachea, you see the lungs on both sides of the heart, underneath the diaphragm, that's a breathing muscle, and underneath that there are all the abdominal organs, including the intestines.
And you can see exactly how it would fit right back into the shell of the body.
Exactly. Yeah. The internal organs are really tightly packed inside the bodily cavities, and there is no space in between. They are really tightly packed. There's no air space.
And that's true for us, too.
Exactly.
We're moving through, and we're starting to, like, pull things apart, and you have this really interesting horse's head over here that has been
cut and sliced.
Cut and sliced, yes.
Exactly. We have left the fur in place. So this is what we humans are usually trained to look at the skin. But the slices allows us to really see great portions of the anatomy. The slice here goes through the mouth. You can see inside the mouth the tongue. You can see part of the teeth. You can see the big nose.
The nasal cavity, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can see the brain, how it is embedded in the skull.
Yeah. It's fascinating because it's not just a picture of it. You're actually seeing the muscles. You're seeing the way the anatomy is functioning or would be functioning.
That is indeed true. I mean, we like to say a picture is worth more than 1,000 words, but if you are standing in front of the real thing, that really is often even emotionally touching you. Since these animals are shown in a very dynamic and beautiful way, with all the skin taken away, showing all the anatomy underneath that, these are very strong and unique pictures. And we humans, we tend to be fascinated most by things we have never seen before. And that is one reason why this exhibit is so well perceived, because people are so positively surprised and take these pictures in the head with them that will certainly move them for many weeks, months, if not even not years to come.
Do you find that some people really react negatively to it, that they find it upsetting or even disgusting?
No, interestingly not. Those who decide to come, they are usually extremely positive about it. And particularly with the human specimens, many people say, I got a complete different view of myself and never again will I take it for granted. If there's any hesitance, then it might be among those who might be, I would say, influenced by the Hollywood industry, who feel if they are real corpses or dead animals on display, that must be disgusting or something eerie. No, it is really not. It is a very scientific, very educational exhibition, and at the same time, very aesthetically accomplished. It's really a wonderful experience if you walk through.
And it's a beautiful, I love the fact that we're in this special exhibition space, because everything is kind of dark around us. We really get to focus on the animals themselves and the different parts that you're trying to show.
Exactly. And this time I'm particularly happy that the exhibition can take place in a zoo, because as a visitor you can experience the animals' life here in a fantastic way, and the exhibit is a wonderful tie-in. It is really a wonderful adjunct.
Take me to this one over here. Is this a sheep over here?
This is indeed a sheep, and we have taken major parts of the muscle system away, so you can see a lot of the skeleton. And what we have also displayed here are major arteries of the blood vessel system.
How long does it take to create this an exhibit like this particular sheep from the time that you get the animal?
The process is pretty time-consuming, and what is also very time-consuming for us is the dissecting work. On a human specimen, that is what we are more trained to do. We calculated we need on an average 1,500 working hours, and the entire process for human body would be a year. With animals, it very much depends on the size. For instance, later on, you will see, you can even already see the head. We have a huge giraffe on display.
Yes.
And that alone took us certainly about 2 years to accomplish. And you must also consider the animal's weight. The larger an animal is, the more equipment you need. You need big forklifts, you need big, big containers where the animal would fit in. You need quite some staff members to do all the work.
I was going to ask you, how many people do you have working with you on just the animal portion of this, not the human portion?
That varies quite a bit, and it varied over the many years. At the very moment, we have around 60 staff members working with us, working in the lab. Most of them are able to work on both animals and humans.
Well, we're walking through, we're getting bigger as we walk through, kind of. Yeah, this is a bull, yes.
That is really a big, big bull, and it's so massive, it's so impressive, and it's really spectacular.
Yeah, you feel like he's going to jump right off the platform.
Yes, it is in fact a principle that we follow for many years, that we have our specimens that we do for public exhibitions have in a very dynamic, lifelike position. This is something we learned from our visitors, in fact, from our first exhibit in Japan, where people, if there was any, let's say, negative comment, they said they look so dead, they look frightening, because the specimens we had on display back then, where they were just like anatomical models, just straight upright. But yeah, that reaction clearly showed us if we want to address lay people, the specimens need to be appealing. They need to serve additional purposes than just the science of it. And yeah, so with the animal exhibit, we really make sure that they are in very natural, lifelike positions. For instance, I very much like the reindeers that we passed already. They are really looking like frozen in a rush.
Yeah, they were galloping across a field and you caught them.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Wally, I want to thank you so much for taking time this morning to talk with me and taking me through a little bit of this. There are many things to see that we didn't even talk about.
I would really invite everyone to see it. Bring the entire family. I'm absolutely sure you will have a wonderful time and an experience that you will never forget in your lifetime. That's something that will reshape the view on nature and perhaps even on yourself.
Dr. Angelina Wally is the curator of all of the Body World's exhibits, including the latest one, Animal Inside Out, which is on display through Labor Day at the Milwaukee County Zoo. This is Lake Effect on 89.7, listener-supported WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. And the listener-supported part of the equation is an important one in the midst of our summer membership drive. We are actually in day one of our summer membership drive, and we are within shouting distance, but we won't shout because this is public radio. But we are closing in on our hourly goal of $650. We can get there with your support. Call us now and make your contribution tax-deductible today, 414-227-3210, or by visiting us online at wuwm.com.
If you can afford a contribution of $10 a month or more, you will get this wonderful T-shirt. This is new to the station.
Makes a great gift.
It does make a great gift. Or you could wear it yourself, because by wearing it, you're announcing that you are a public radio nerd. And I have to say, we are.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, and for those of you who think that that's, you know, we're just describing ourselves that way, the shirt actually says public radio nerd on it.
Yes, yes, it actually does. You can claim that yourself. It has our logo and NPR's logo on it as well. It comes in gray or black in a variety of sizes. That is a $10 contribution a month or more, and you will automatically get one of those unless you say, no, I don't want it. I don't know why you would say that.
I can't imagine. You could certainly give it to someone else, your favorite public radio nerd that's close to you. Today only, by the way, anyone who contributes is eligible to win a $1,000 travel voucher from Fox World Travel. You're not required to make a contribution, but it is much appreciated. So be sure to take advantage of that. Again, anyone who makes a contribution today is eligible to win a $1,000 travel voucher. It's kind of an amazing opportunity. And best of all, you are supporting this program that you hear each and every day, Lake Effect, along with the program you'll hear next, Fresh Air, also Here and Now in just a few minutes or about an hour's time, all things considered, all the programs that you rely on each and every day right here on WUWM.
That is listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, and that brings us to a close of Lake Effect today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Have a great day. Hope we'll see you back here at 10 o'clock again tomorrow, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.